Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis clarifying if and when international sanctions on North Korea will be lifted.
As defense ministers, we must maintain a strong, collaborative, defensive stance so we enable our diplomats to negotiate from a calm position of strength in this critical time. Especially now, we must remain vigilant, and we will continue to implement all UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea. North Korea will receive relief only when it demonstrates verifiable and irreversible steps to denuclearization.
U.S. and North Korean officials continue to lay the groundwork ahead of the expected summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says he plans to visit North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. North Korean state media reported this on Sunday.
The meeting was reported by North Korea's KCNA news agency. There has been no immediate comment from the Syrian president's office. Assad reportedly announced the plans as he received the credentials of North Korean ambassador Moon Jong-nam. Pyongyang and Damascus have historically maintained good relations. The UN has even accused North Korea of cooperating with Syria on chemical weapons, a charge the North denies. Both countries have faced international condemnation, North Korea over its nuclear weapons program and Syria over its tactics during a bloody civil war. Since the beginning of the year, Kim Jong-un has launched a flurry of diplomatic meetings with leaders in China and South Korea.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting, and this comes as U.S. President Donald Trump prepares to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This is VOA News. Pakistan says at least six militants were killed and five soldiers wounded in shootouts along the troubled border with Afghanistan. A military statement noted that in the past 24 hours, terrorists from the Afghan side staged repeated fire raids and physical attacks on Pakistani outposts and border fencing teams. It said security forces responded effectively and repulsed the attacks in the northwestern and southwestern parts of the area. The area suffered seven cross-border militant attacks since Saturday. Several thousand Jordanians have joined the largest protest yet against the government's recent austerity measures, including price hikes and planned tax increases. Riot police scuffled with demonstrators late Saturday and fired several tear gas volleys to keep them away from the prime minister's office. Protesters chanted, "The people want to topple the government." China is warning U.S. trade deals are off if a tariff threats are followed up. AP correspondent Charles De La Desma reporting.
China has warned any deals produced will not take effect if President Donald Trump's threatened tariff hike on Chinese goods goes ahead. The warning comes after top officials wrapped up a meeting on Beijing's pledge to narrow its trade surplus. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said they had discussed specific American exports China might purchase, but the talks ended with no joint statement, and neither side released details. Washington is pressing Beijing to narrow its politically volatile trade surplus with the U.S., which reached a record $375.2 billion last year. I'm Charles De La Desma.
The United States is being singled out by its allies over the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum. At the G7 finance ministers' meeting in Canada, they expressed their concern and disappointment over the tariffs. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
There's a lot of issues that are going on. The president's been personally involved in our trade updates. We meet with him almost every week on these issues. And again, I'm sure he will be addressing with the other leaders the trade issues.
He's referring to a G7 meeting in Quebec this week to be attended by U.S. President Donald Trump. At least four Somali soldiers were killed and more than 10 others were wounded when al-Shabaab militants stormed a military base in a semi-autonomous region of Puntland in northeastern Somalia. Sources say scores of heavily armed al-Shabaab militants carried out the raid on the base as they burned a number of military vehicles. The French news agency is reporting five new suspected cases of the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo. AFP reported Saturday that DRC health authorities recorded two new cases of illness in one area, three in another. Both areas are in the Northwest Province. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Kloche has the day off.
The importance of Egyptian human development, and he said that I will concentrate on education, health, and culture because we have to respond to ideas against the nation.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is sworn in for a second term.
We believe that these flights and other activities that IOM is doing in Libya is assisting in getting people home, and that is reducing the risk and the actual fatalities of some of the world's most vulnerable migrants from this route across the Mediterranean.
The International Organization for Migration repatriates 150 Somali migrants stranded in Libya.
We're working with those communities to improve their water supplies, whether that's building new boreholes or linking them up to improve quality of water so they can withstand climate problems and also, you know, improve their lives and their prosperity.
And the city of Cape Town in South Africa enters its fourth year of drought. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was sworn in for a second term before the Egyptian parliament Saturday, telling legislators that he considered himself to be the president of all Egyptians, both for those who support him and those who do not. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The Speaker of Egypt's Parliament, Ali Abdel Al, introduced President Sisi to lawmakers, telling them that he had been officially declared the victor of the country's presidential election in April by the country's Electoral Commission. Sisi won more than 90% of the vote in a contest that pitted him against a relatively unknown architect who entered the race at the last minute. Several more well-known candidates either withdrew or were declared ineligible to run for office. Sisi took the oath of office, saying he vowed before God to preserve the country's republican system of government, respect the constitution, and preserve both the independence and unity of the state and its people. In a brief speech to Parliament following his swearing-in, Sisi told legislators that despite all the quarrels and contention among Egyptians that the country has been through since the 2011 revolution, it was his aim to unite everyone. He says he considers himself the president of both those who agree with them and those who disagree, and asked for the sincere efforts and courage of everyone, saying Egypt deserves that we live and die for her and her great people. Sisi blasted those people and forces he claimed damaged the country in the struggles that overtook Egypt since 2011. He says he intends to work to build a future and fashion a path toward tomorrow that will accomplish the people's dreams for a modern state built on a foundation of freedom and democracy and restoring Egypt's rightful place among the nations, which was damaged as a result of domestic and external doings. Sisi went on to stress that Egyptians have fought together against brutal terrorism and defeated it despite its efforts to tear apart society and the heavy social, economic, and political price it has imposed on everyone. Political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that President Sisi also spoke about a cultural revival and rebuilding the country's cultural identity.
He emphasizes the importance of Egyptian human development, and he said that I will concentrate on education, health, and culture, because we have to respond to ideas against the nation.
Sadiq added that Sisi spoke briefly about the economy, saying he was planning to continue with economic reforms that he undertook during his first term, including the gradual lifting of subsidies on fuel. An official military honor guard fired a 21-gun salute following the swearing-in ceremony as legislators applauded the president inside parliament. Egyptian F-16 fighter jets also circled the center of Cairo to mark the event. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The International Organization for Migration says it has repatriated 150 Somali migrants stranded in Libya this past week. Most had been held in government-run detention centers for months under terrible conditions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The returning Somali migrants account for only a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees living in precarious conditions in Libya. The International Organization for Migration believes as many as 1 million people, most from Arab and African countries, have made the dangerous journey to Libya as the gateway to Europe and a better life. But the reality upon arrival is quite different. IOM says migrants in Libya are exposed to many risks, including smuggling, trafficking, kidnapping, abuse, detention, and torture. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the organization's voluntary repatriation program has saved thousands of migrants of different nationalities from this dire fate.
We believe that these flights and other activities that IOM is doing in Libya is assisting in getting people home, and that is reducing the risk and the actual fatalities of some of the world's most vulnerable migrants from this route across the Mediterranean.
Data show nearly 30,000 Somali migrants and refugees have left Libya by sea for Italy since 2014. Millman says this latest voluntary humanitarian return of migrants from Libya to Somalia was the fourth and the largest. He says it also was the first chartered nonstop flight from the Libyan capital Tripoli to Somalia's capital Mogadishu. He says IOM plans to return around 300 other vulnerable Somali migrants in Libya back to Mogadishu in the coming weeks. Upon return, he says, the migrants are given psychological counseling and some assistance to help them reintegrate into their home communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Health workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo are racing against time to contain an outbreak of Ebola. In its latest report, the World Health Organization says 25 people have died out of the 858 people who have gotten the virus. VOA's Cara Pearson tells us about the vaccine being used to prevent the spread of Ebola.
In Bikoro, people celebrated a man's recovery from Ebola. Wangi Nondi says he developed a fever after caring for his brother, who died from Ebola. He recovered at a treatment center in the small town where Ebola first surfaced in Congo in early May. One of the differences between this outbreak compared to previous ones is that there is a vaccine. Doctors are vaccinating everyone they can find who has been exposed to the virus, but health workers are still discovering new cases not at all related to those cases they have already confirmed. What this means is that the virus is still actively spreading, and health workers still don't have an accurate picture of what's going on. Congo's vaccination campaign is targeting more than 1,000 health workers, along with family and friends, neighbors and work colleagues of the Ebola patients. Health workers are using a ring approach, where they identify newly diagnosed Ebola patients and then set about locating all the people these patients have been in contact with. That could include shopkeepers and members of a church. The vaccine being used was developed during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa a few years ago. The vaccine is not yet licensed, but its clinical trial has shown that it is safe and effective. Tarek Makotope is a vaccine researcher at University College London. Here he explains how the Ebola vaccine works.
What it does, it teaches the immune system to recognize those Ebola proteins on the surface of this modified virus, and in doing so, create a protective response against that.
Because the vaccine can only be tested when there is an Ebola outbreak, Makotope says there are many unknowns.
What we're trying to do now is to establish how effective is this vaccine? Do you need one dose or two doses to be protective? And once you've been injected or vaccinated with this, how long does that protection last for as well?
Containing the Ebola virus is difficult because many areas impacted by the outbreak are close to heavily used waterways. The outbreak started in rural Bikoro and then moved to Mbandaka, a busy port city along the Congo River. Congo's capital, Kinshasa, is about 4 hours south. Produce from rural areas is taken to Mbandaka and then shipped downriver to Kinshasa. Tamping down the outbreak in Mbandaka that originated in Bikoro and keeping the virus out of Kinshasa is critical to containing this particular Ebola outbreak. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
New York City is well known as a global marketplace for art and design. Both were abundantly on offer recently at the Jarvis Convention Center in Manhattan, where artists, interior designers, licensing agents, and others gathered for the annual SATEX and ICCF trade shows. VOA's Adam Phillips took a look at some of the African-based products on display.
There are hundreds of exhibitors, large and small, here at the Javits Center, all of them passionate about what they're showing. Take Joanne Schofield, for example. She's the founder and director of From the Tribe, a small British firm that buys unusual traditional arts in rural Africa and sells them to high-end interior decorators and designers in the West. Among her wares are intricate, brilliantly colored beaded necklaces Maasai women wear when dancing, and small, tortoise-shaped wooden bowls from northern Kenya and southern Ethiopia that she has refashioned into elegant lamps.
They're beautifully rounded, beautifully hand-carved with tribal designs in lovely warm African sand colors, dark and light and bleached, almost like they've just got stories to tell.
African tribal designs are highly prized in chic, minimalist homes in New York, London, Paris, and other world capitals, Schofield says. She points to a pair of large chairs entirely covered in ornate glass beadwork. Each one took 3 months to make. They were crafted by the Yoruba people of Nigeria in patterns once intended for kings and queens. Today, non-royals can have them too.
They're made as an investment piece for families, and families then sell them, and they might pay for school fees, they might pass it on to their family as an heirloom, and then the designs on them, like this one, for instance, is bright colours with zigzags, with African masks, little jumping bunny rabbits, and elephants. So quite a kind of unusual combination of design, but it somehow worked.
Schofield has a personal relationship with the artisans who make these products. She says mobile phone technology has helped them to prosper along with her.
They are delighted to get orders. They work very, very hard. And I pay them exactly what they ask. Mm-hmm. And then I just work out my prices mm-hmm. from that. Believe it or not, the men make these beaded chairs. They've got the patience to make these beautiful beaded chairs, and they're training all the young men to do it. Whereas before, I'm sure they were just leaving the villages, going to the cities, and it's wonderful.
Works out for everybody.
That's right, works for everybody. And it's so lovely seeing their art and their culture being celebrated.
Development and design also come together at All Across Africa, a company from National City, California. The company commissions and sells basketry from Ghana, Rwanda, and Uganda. Alicia Wallace once worked for a nonprofit group that promoted school scholarships for African children. She says that one day, a group of local women told her, "Thank you, but we need jobs so we can afford to send our kids to school ourselves." Wallace founded All Across Africa in response.
So we established them as an independent business. We train them in finance, negotiation, material sourcing, etc. And then we place orders and purchase from them on a weekly basis. And then they're also able to open up the marketplace and have other buyers as well.
She shows off a tall bamboo and sweetgrass basket from Rwanda. It was made in the traditional way by two artisans. One constructed the inner frame. The other wove and colored the exterior.
The black part is actually dyed from charcoal, so every now and then if you push it hard enough, you'll see the charcoal that comes off. And then the red orange is from their clay. Like, this is what the dirt roads all look like in Rwanda, and that's how they achieve that color. So absolutely traditional. We're not influencing shape, design, or pattern in any way in this one.
Many of All Across Africa's products combine traditional styles with modern touches created by American designers. A banana fiber wall plate from Uganda bears an abstract design that vaguely resembles a spider or perhaps a multi-armed star.
A New York designer traveled to Uganda and used modern art inspiration to create this art, sat with the artisans day in and day out to actually teach them this new pattern. So it's one of our best-selling pieces here at the show.
Tiana Deneen Harris of Digital Kente also favors a hybrid approach. She uses computer software to design textiles that marry West African weaving patterns to her own vibrant color schemes.
I definitely think my style fits into the Afrofuturistic theme, being inspired by African aesthetic, but making it more modern.
Harris has digitally altered one Kente palm leaf design in a way that reminds her of wings. She and other exhibitors hope the Surtex show, held every May, becomes an opportunity for their designs to take flight. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The international media and climate change experts continue to focus on Cape Town as the South African city enters its fourth year of drought. But one of the world's leading water agencies says slow burning droughts have been devastating other parts of Africa to a much greater degree, with some countries suffering water and food shortages. The Water Aid Organization works to bring clean water to some of the world's poorest communities, including Southern Africa. Darren Taylor reports for VOA.
Jonathan Farr leads WaterAid's work on climate change and water security.
We should remember that there are already 844 million people in the world who lack basic access to water. More than 8 million of those people live in South Africa.
The policy analyst says water crises caused by the El Niño weather pattern have gripped Southern Africa since 2015.
This is the worst drought to hit the region for 35 years. By the beginning of last year, it affected about 41 million people in countries including Mozambique, Madagascar, Malawi, Zambia, and of course South Africa.
Farr says some of these places are much worse off than Cape Town.
In 2016, the government of Madagascar declared a state of emergency in southern Madagascar, with almost a million people facing alarming levels of hunger. In Malawi, there's been a state of national disaster declared, with 25 out of 28 parts of the country having severe food shortages.
Mozambique, too, is enduring water restrictions that are far more severe than those in Cape Town.
The government in Maputo called an Amber Alert, and that means that as well as a public awareness and campaign about reducing water use, there's ongoing total restrictions of water supply for agriculture and energy.
FAR says water security is threatened across Africa because of hotter, drier weather and other reasons.
Lots of people are moving from rural communities to cities. The cities aren't ready for this huge influx of people. And so there's increasing demand for water, but in a very small area. And so it does mean there's huge pressures on particular water basins. And so the authorities, you know, even those who are reacting well, are dealing with a very serious problem.
He says many southern African countries are not managing their water properly.
They've just been losing a lot of water, whether that's through poor infrastructure, lack of maintenance, or people tapping into the system illegally. These authorities governing the water have not been taking account of their water, not collecting revenues, which means they're losing money, which means they can't afford to keep up the maintenance.
This creates a big gap that WaterAid does its best to fill.
So we're working with those communities to improve their water supplies, whether that's building boreholes or linking them up to improve quality water so they can withstand climate problems and also, you know, improve their lives and their prosperity.
FAR's organization cooperates with governments, engineers and architects to assess threats to water supplies. It also helps to build feasible infrastructure, like in Maputo, where it's assisting Mozambicans to tap into previously unused water basins near the city. But if droughts are so much more serious in other parts of southern Africa, why are they largely out of the public eye? Why all the attention on Cape Town? FAR says there are a few reasons for the international community focusing heavily on this city at the southern tip of Africa.
You've got the deadline of day zero, and that's dramatic. It catches headlines, and it's got this looming threat.
Day zero is the point at which the authorities may cut water to most homes in Cape Town, forcing people to queue for small rations of the resource. FAR says the situation in Cape Town has captured the attention of the developed world because it has much more in common with the city than other drought-stricken areas in southern Africa.
And the impact on Cape Town, which has got a very high standard of living and has water withdrawals that include tourism and scientific research and industry. So the potential economic costs there for running out of water are absolutely gigantic. This is a message that resonates around the world, because if Cape Town's running out of water, there's lots of cities that also have to look at their own situation and say, well, maybe this could be us in the not-too-distant future.
The Cape Town municipality says it's unlikely that the city will run out of water this year, mainly because inhabitants are now saving a lot of water. The local government's also investing in alternative water sources, such as groundwater extraction. FAR says these actions should be an example to the world.
It's not about, can we spend billions on new infrastructure? It's not about, oh, let's hope for the weather to improve. It's about looking at what are the threats to water, where water comes from, what's being used for, and thinking, well, can we make sure that's being done better? And as Cape Town has demonstrated, when you do it better, you can find significant water resources, you know, fairly easily.
WaterAid wants to see the urgency in Cape Town spread and for states to prioritise water security. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. The weekend's here, and I'm here too, to try and make it just a little sweeter for you. Enjoy 55 minutes of pure, commercial-free, Pan-African music. Killer kizomba, amazing Afro beats, Kenyan Afro pop, and more. Plus, get the latest music news. I've also got a live studio session of beautiful music for you with Congolese singer-songwriter Zsa Zsa. So sweeten up with me on Music Time in Africa this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Uh-huh.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Yes, now it's time for a Sunday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Subar khirim benzi wa ona di halia ko.
Sabah nuril azizi halia ko kama yako.
Wa ona je wa sazi nyumbani utoke hapo. Jiwezi dawa ya busura yako
ebu nitoe majonzi nijuze shida yako
shida yangu sijiwezi dawa ya busura yako
wengine wachomozi na kupenda peke yako wengine wachomozi na kupenda peke yako. Shana zidi spidi Usini yache baby Nanipa piko la kigahidi Asi mororo Najua uko na mimi mpenzi Usijewe Kwanya kiporo Najua kulia chaka wezi Yeah, yeah, yeah
Kiwa mbali baby Muzako pressure na zidi spidi Usini yache baby Utanipa piko la kigahidi.
Whatever the case may be, make it don't say you got a hold on me. The
girl of my dreams, so soggy. Baby, all the kind of possible to see you again. Sun they shine, rain they fall, wind they blow. Girl, I think of you. Weather for two, baby, where are you? Can't you see the way that I'm missing you? You're making me the fumble, I tumble, I lose my mind. Tell me how to make you realize. So now you be the reason when it's strong, man, they do totally, yeah. Baby, waiting be the thing where you put for my body, yeah. That thing where they officially make me misbehave. Baby, waiting be the thing where you put for my system, yeah. The same thing where they normally they do me totally, yeah. That's it.
You just a flash, you don't be worried.
Baby,
Yes, that was our Sunday music spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As the international community observes the grave risks of a global trade war involving the United States and major trade blocs such as NAFTA and the European Union and countries such as China. Below the radar, a number of East African countries are faced with their own trade policy with the United States. With respect to China, the U.S. Commerce Secretary over the weekend has been visiting China to discuss trade policy between the United States and China, and the outcome will depend whether the Trump administration will impose new tariffs on Chinese products. As far as Mexico and China are concerned, and the European countries, the Trump administration has revived its high tariff on steel and aluminium on those countries, and all those countries are fighting back with the possibility of their own tariff increase against United States project. In the case of East Africa, the problem is the sale of used or close their countries. African countries throughout the continent have long been concerned about the import of used and second-hand clothes to their countries, fearing that they may have health repercussions. But because these materials are cheap, it has been very difficult for many African countries to deal with the problem. Now, the East African countries of Rwanda, Uganda, and Tanzania have decided to tackle the problem head on. In the case of Rwanda, the argument has been made that it is undignified for Africans to be wearing used clothes or second-hand clothes, and they have moved to stop it. In the case of Uganda, it has used a new argument. It said it needs to protect its infant textile industry, and in that regard, it has decided to increase the tariff of the import of used clothes. The Trump administration has pushed back on these moves, and it has threatened to deny any AGOA benefits to those countries trying to prevent import of used or second-hand clothes to their countries. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, was signed in May 2000 by the Clinton administration to assist African countries import goods to the United States duty-free. It has been very helpful, although recently some have been arguing that its popularity is declining. So these African countries will have to determine what they wish to do with respect to AGOA. But above all, Africans have to begin to think seriously as to what may happen if there is a global trade war, taking into account the historical fact that the trade war in the 1930s preceded the slowdown of economic matters in the Western world. And some believe that this may have been responsible for the outbreak of the Second World War. So a major international trade war will have repercussions in Africa. The African states have been complaining within the World Trade Organization, WTO, that even now they are having difficulties exporting the commodity products because many European countries, such as the European Union and the U.S., have been giving subsidies to their agricultural products. One must recall that in President Trump's inauguration last year, he made clear that America will put its country first, American first. And then he added that any other country that wishes to do the same, he could understand it. But what Africans should know, and I think the global community should know, that in an environment where every country is asserting its me-first policy, it is clear what the result will be. Those that are strong and better organized will always be the victor. So thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saeed Hamdun, and our engineer for tonight, John Dryden, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpoga. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 17, 2014, a Malaysia Airlines passenger airplane, designated as Flight MH17, left Amsterdam for Kuala Lumpur with 298 passengers and crew. 3 hours into its flight, the airplane was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine. All 298 people on board died. Most of the victims were Dutch, Malaysians, and Australians. As a direct result of Russia's aggression in Ukraine, by mid-July 2014, Ukrainian security forces and Russia-led forces had been fighting in southeastern Ukraine for over 3 months. It is worth noting that on July 14th, just 3 days before MH17 was destroyed, two Ukrainian military aircraft were shot down by the Russia-led forces using Russian Buk surface-to-air missiles. The International Civil Aviation Organization warned governments not to overfly southeastern Ukraine, but this warning did not include the region where MH17 crashed. On May 24, 2018, a Dutch-led international team of investigators announced that Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 had been shot out of the sky by pro-Russian separatists using a Buk missile that had been transported into eastern Ukraine from a Russian military unit based in western Russia. The Buk missile was fired from Russia-controlled territory in eastern Ukraine. Because Russia provided the weapon, the Netherlands and Australia are seeking to hold Russia accountable for the tragedy. Despite these facts, Russia continues to deny its involvement. We strongly support the decisions by the Netherlands and Australia to call Russia to account for its role in the July 2014 downing of Malaysia Flight No. 17 over eastern Ukraine and the horrific deaths of 298 civilians. It is time for Russia to acknowledge its role in the shooting down of MH17 and to cease its callous disinformation campaign, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. As the findings of the joint investigative team made clear, the Buk missile launcher used to bring down the passenger aircraft is owned by the Russian Federation and was assigned to the Russian 53rd Anti-Aircraft Brigade near Kursk. It was brought into sovereign Ukrainian territory from Russia, was fired from territory controlled by Russia and Russian-led forces in eastern Ukraine, and was then returned to Russian territory. We urge Russia to adhere to UNSCR 2166 and respond to Australia's and the Netherlands' legitimate requests.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.